You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 21st to the 27th of August 2014. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporters Jack Grove, Holly Elson, David Matthews and editor John Gill. How has the increase in tuition fees impacted on student demand for particular courses? Good news for physics, not so good for modern foreign languages, as we'll hear in just a moment. Do universities overreact to academics who tweet? We have a story this week on one academic who felt her institution was a little overzealous in its reaction to her online comments, and a couple of other institutions with social media policies that seem a little restrictive, to put it mildly. As tuition fees for international students rise, what might happen if the 9k fee cap on domestic students is lifted? David will tell us a bit more in a second about that. And finally, sports psychologist Tanya Brunsel, has been talking to Jack about her participation in the dietary and training regimes of female bodybuilders and how that gave her a valuable insight into the mindset of these so-called gender outlaws. But first, a study by HEFCE, the Higher Education Funding Council for England, has shed some light on how subjects are performing following the introduction of £9,000 fees. It's a joint byline between Holly and David. Holly, we'll start with you. It's a mixed picture, but STEM holding up well.
So yeah, this is some data from HEFCE that looks at acceptances for different subjects, both before and after the introduction of tuition fee, the higher level of tuition fees. And we're finding that science, technology and engineering and maths subjects acceptances are actually up on what they were previously. Mm-hmm. Whereas other subjects, modern foreign languages, for example, are down. So some people are saying that people are perhaps more drawn towards STEM subjects because there is higher chance of them getting a well-paid job, whereas modern foreign languages have been declining for some time.
And the percentage of changes in UCAS acceptances between 2011-12 and 13-14, physics is up 14%, bioscience is up 9%, but David, modern foreign language is down 18%.
Yeah, it's been a really sort of quite dramatic fall for modern foreign languages. So they're down by more than a fifth the 2 years to 2012-13, which is when the higher fees were introduced. And then for this most recent year, 13-14, it was down, UCAS acceptances down another 7%. So it doesn't look like there's any let up in the kind of fall for modern foreign languages. And, you know, people have made the point it's very important for the UK economy that people can actually speak to people who can't speak English. Not just the traditional markets in France, Germany and so on, but China, Arabic and so on. Both these areas, STEM and modern foreign languages, are classified as strategically important and vulnerable by HEFCE. So they know that there's a threat to them. But STEM seems to have succeeded, or rather the kind of government seems to have succeeded in protecting STEM from the worst of the fallout from the fees, but not so much modern foreign languages.
You make the point in the story, don't you, that there were fears with the introduction of, with the change in the funding mechanisms, that STEM would be in danger because it's obviously a more expensive subject to teach, and there was, you know, the suspicion among some was that universities would start to cherry pick the kind of cheaper classroom based subjects to teach instead. But I think one of the very obvious trends of the last few years has been the incredibly strong and well organised science lobby. I mean, it's kind of had a very strong narrative built around it, hasn't it, STEM, in terms of all sorts of things, not least graduate employment rates and the likelihood that you'll go on and have a higher earning job. So, I mean, that has been an area that's been very well served by perhaps quite politically active academics within the STEM subjects, and also lobby groups that are explicitly, you know, trying to defend STEM.
Well, when this was raised before the fees came up, that it would just be too expensive to teach STEM. I mean, to be fair, I mean, what, you know, David Willetts always used to say is, well, there is still teaching grant for high cost subjects, which is most of the STEM subjects, including maths, and it does appear that has been enough, or it's at least universe well, unless universities are heavily cross-subsidising STEM from other subjects, which is a possibility.
I think they are. That's what I've heard. I hear continually when talking to sort of people high up in that field. They say that the CIVS money is not enough to cover the cost, especially in engineering, because it's such an expensive subject to teach. And, you know, universities are making a loss on these places.
In terms of actual student demand, I mean, that's quite an attractive thought if you're a student that's paying £9,000 fees, that you're paying your £9,000 to study physics or medicine or whatever it is, and actually you're getting significantly more from the university than you're paying for. Whereas actually it's a much less attractive proposition that you're there, you're going there to study English or history and paying your £9,000 and you're busy cross-subsidising the person down the corridor. I mean, from the student's point of view, you can kind of see, again, why that actually is quite a pro-STEM narrative.
Yeah. And with modern languages, the problem is that it's a four-year course, generally. And although you do get a rebate of 1 year, lots of people might think, well, I'd rather do a three-year course and just get out into the labour market and start earning rather than doing another year, which maybe... But actually... you know, that fourth year, one of those years is actually a year abroad, so it could be quite fun.
It is quite problematic, though, isn't it, with the lack of languages?
Well, there's that joke, isn't there? What do you call someone who speaks two languages?
Bilingual.
And what do you call someone who speaks three languages?
Trilingual.
And what do you call someone who speaks one language?
English.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're very good. Well, there we go, on that light-hearted note. You can read that story and all its more serious implications on page 6 and 7 in this week's magazine. The second story we're covering this week is one of mine, actually. I've been looking into some of the social media policies of UK universities. Now, a lot of universities publish these online, so it sort of dictates to staff what they should and shouldn't do when they're tweeting, when they're using Facebook. And it's an issue that's popped up quite a bit. But one scholar got in touch with me, Carol McCartney, who was in Leeds University at the time. She's now at Northumbria, to tell me about a time when she was reprimanded for actually questioning some of the policies of Home Secretary Theresa May, which is not something the THE would ever get involved with, of course. But she received a long email from her university, sort of instructing her that it was too political. She shouldn't get involved with things that might not. In a way that might not represent the views of the university. Now, the university itself says that they simply asked her to add a suitable disclaimer, sort of making it clear that her views were not those of the university. But as she pointed out, you can easily Google who these people are. You know, it's quite clear where they're employed within HE. And she just sort of says that this is a little bit overzealous and there's no need to clamp down quite so much. Mm. But it led me to sort of Google some of these other policies, and a couple sort of make the story this week. Edinburgh Napier... its guidelines urge staff to avoid social media communications that could damage the university's reputation, which I think is quite an interesting one. Clearly quite restrictive if people want to have their say on what's going on while they're at work. And then the University of Kent's policy I thought was quite interesting. They said that staff should inform the alumni relations team if they intend to engage with former students online. Now, if you imagine how many students, your average lecturer, sort of teachers, and any relationship that develop afterwards, you know, for any sort of tweets that go to them to be vetted, as it were, seems a bit harsh. They did say again, Kent, that this was only intended for people wishing to set up a dedicated alumni platform. But if you read the wording of the actual policy, it certainly doesn't say that.
Yeah, I suppose it's just it all comes down to how these policies are implemented, doesn't it? And I mean, the Leeds example almost sounded more like cock up the conspiracy with the kind of webmaster contacting her, but actually the fact that the university subsequently came back and did ask her to add that disclaimer on her bio on Twitter suggests that actually it was endorsing the webmaster's approach to a certain extent.
Yeah, and Lee's actually been in trouble before. We covered in 2010 the fact that they were asked to they had to remove a social networking code from their website, which warned students and staff that it was unacceptable to criticise the university. That was after a bit of an outcry online. So there's a bit of a track record there.
It's what's really slightly underlying thing in all of this. You know, so the Leeds policy is, you know, you cannot, you know, you've got to be clear that you're not representing the views of Leeds University. What are the views of the university?
Exactly.
Isn't it a university? Yeah. It's just a collection of people, and I mean, is there some sort of corporate political position that you? It's the views of the university, this seems to come up quite a lot in stories we do, not just this.
Mm.
And I've always thought it really weird. How can a university have views that are somehow separate from its members?
It strikes me, or it smacks a bit of universities not quite being fully up to speed on how social media works. I mean, it's not something that you can control in any corporate sense. I mean, it just doesn't work like that. So it would be a bit like me saying that none of you can, you know, all your tweets have to represent the views of the magazine. I mean, to a certain extent, that's true, but equally, it's not something that you sort of dictate or you know, the fact that you are trusted members of staff makes you are the views of THG. That, as you say, it's the staff that make the magazine and the way that the staff that make the university. So it's a bit of an odd approach to take.
Indeed, yeah, it wasn't the only story that I received. Actually, there could be follow-ups to this based on another of other academics who've been in touch. Some one tweet involving a picture suggesting they've been at a boozy dinner, perhaps leading to some comeback. Another where a sort of piece of equipment was photographed that sort of could have been commercially sensitive to the person who produced it. So, you know, universities clearly are sort of imposing themselves on some academics and some of what they do. And I guess in some cases it is called for, but certainly not in all cases. Moving on, though, to our cover feature. David, it's you again. Details of tuition fees, both domestic and international, at UK institutions, published in some detail in this week's magazine. You've written the analysis that runs alongside.
Yes, so every year we give a big rundown of tuition fees for undergraduates, international students, MBAs, postgraduates, and so on. And each year we sort of try to look at, you know, what they might mean. And one of the big questions for next Parliament, at least anyway, is whether the £9,000 tuition fee cap will come off, because the vice chancellors are increasingly raising their voices, saying it's not enough, it's been chipped away at inflation, by inflation since it was set in 2012-13, they need more money. And so I tried to look into what would happen if you did have no cap on tuition fees. What would happen? Now, if you look at what's happened to other fees, so international students, undergraduates, they pay a lot more than undergraduate, because obviously there is this, sorry, home undergraduate, because there's a £9,000 cap. So you would think, well, you know, if there's no limit on this, then you know, they would go shooting up, and I'm sure that's exactly what would happen at some universities. But it is a bit more complicated than that, because, well, first of all, I mean, the international students tend, you know, there's this huge world market for this huge demand for places at UK universities, and so potentially they've got more money than you'd be able to access as a UK undergraduate. And there's other things. So it's been suggested that the £9,000 cap actually increases the average tuition fee, because everyone wants to charge £9,000, otherwise they fear they'll be seen as cheap. Now, so there's this suggestion that if you remove that, they might, some actually might feel free to drop. However, people I've spoken to think that's quite unlikely, because if you reduce your fees, then you know, you would you'd also be seen as cheap.
Yeah, it'd be the same allegation.
Exactly, you'd be backtracking. So all in all, I mean, I think the suggestion is that, well, you know, the sort of Oxford, Cambridge, and a few others of this world would be able to charge, you know, 16 going up to maybe £20,000 a year, but given the pressures on government finances, it's very unlikely that the government would simply say to all universities, well, you can charge what you wish, and basically it's akin to writing a blank cheque, effectively. So,
but are the international fees? I mean, they're set, they're not capped, they set those presumably at the level they think that the course they're offering is worth. So
yeah,
why
exactly.
not? Why would exactly. we not simply see the sort of a blanket charge, this is what we think this fee is worth for both domestic and overseas students, and that's
the
price.
So they set it at the level they think the course is worth, or the level they think the market will bear?
I think it's the latter. I mean, I think we've seen, you know, inflation busting rises over the past few years. I think they're setting up what they can get away with, really.
And I think as well, it's definitely the case that, you know, international student fees are the one income stream that has really been, you know, in universities' own control. And I think they've used it. You know, we talked about cross subsidies earlier. I think international fees are a very obvious area where they've been able to sort of build up significant surpluses to cover deficits in other areas. Mm.
You only have to look at the overseas postgraduate fees versus the home postgraduate fees to see this enormous difference between the two. I mean, it's, you know, it's almost double. Mm. Is it double? It's actually more than double, in fact, in some areas. You know, just because simply because you're from overseas and not at home, and it's because there are, you know, lots of people all across the world with wealthy families, and they can afford this. Whereas
that's simple supply and demand, Dave.
Well, exactly, exactly. I mean, we sort of throw up our hands in the horror at the idea that there's a market for undergraduates in the UK, but actually, this has been the case for many years in other areas.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very data-heavy story, as well as your analysis piece. There are full details of the annual tuition fee data for full-time courses at UK institutions. I know that readers will enjoy picking their way through those. Our second feature this week, though, Jack, is one of yours. It's part of our Outer Limits series, subtitled Research Outside the Comfort Zone. You've been speaking to Tanya Bunsell, lecturer in sports psychology at St Mary's University, about the world of female bodybuilding.
Yes, this is a lady who, for her PhD, decided to sort of go and train and sort of exist with female bodybuilders. And apparently this is a sort of subculture that I'm not really aware of, but there are female bodybuilders, and they train intensively. They eat protein every 2 hours, and they take supplements to make sure that they've got these ripped physiques. And Tanya Bunsell decided to sort of do as much as she could to sort of become one of these female bodybuilders. She couldn't quite match their physiques in the end, but she did. Her body did change. I mean, she put on about a stone of muscle, and her she put 2 inches on her arms, and her clothes didn't fit. She got lots of sort of quite disparaging comments from her family and friends and students, saying, "Why are you doing this?" But she really wanted to get inside the mind of these people and understand why they did it.
And by doing that, I suppose you get better information from the people who exist in that world full-time. I noticed one of the taboo subjects you write about is muscle worship, a fetishism where men pay around £300 an hour to touch or kiss female bodybuilders' rippling physiques.
Yeah, I think if you saw Louis Theroux Weird Weekends, there was quite a memorable episode where he followed these men around and they were sort of pummeled by these very macho women. And this was the image that has been created around these people, but Tanya actually found that it wasn't so much the case. It was quite sort of well-adjusted men, university graduates, good jobs, middle class.
Like the people in this room.
Yeah, very much so. So, and it's very interesting because the idea of body image and it is very much in the news at the moment, and you know, whether it's one form, whether it's anorexia, or whether it's people taking steroids to have huge muscles, there's quite an interesting discourse going on about, you know, how we should look and what's being foisted on us. And these female bodybuilders seem to have sort of created their own self-identity, and they're not that bothered what other people think. And I think it's quite interesting that she's really sort of immersed herself in their world.
How was her PhD different, or, you know, was it? Did she think it was better for having actually done this?
Well, that's the sort of the big debate: whether you should sort of stand back and be a clinical observer, or whether you should really sort of get in, you know, enter that world and be sort of go native almost. And she thinks that the latter approach is better because you really get to understand the mindset of these people. And you know, there are risks, of course, but you get a sort of much more sensuous way of understanding what they're going through.
Well, it's a fascinating interview on page 36 this week. That's all for the Issue Review podcast. We do have a second podcast
this week. It's one of our books podcasts. Karen Shook, our books editor, has been speaking to Laurie Taylor and Sally Feldman about their new book on the nature of celebrity, which is called In Confidence, Talking Frankly About Fame. Lots of anecdotes in there. Celebrities covered range from David Starkey to Johnny Rotten and even Kermit the Frog. So do have a listen to that. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed, or indeed anything that you read on Times Higher Education, do get in touch. You can find us at timeshighereducation.co.uk. We're on Twitter at Times Higher Ed. We're on Facebook, LinkedIn and Google Plus as well. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.